You're listening to the Bible for Normal People, the only God-ordained podcast on the internet. Serious talk about the sacred book. I'm Pete Enns.
And I'm Jared Bias.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this episode of our podcast. And our episode today is Pete Holmes on why the Bible is way interesting. And you can probably guess who our guest is.
I don't know. Who is it?
Who is Pete Holmes? Who does Pete Holmes think he is? That's all these questions will be answered.
What is Pete Holmes?
What is Pete Holmes? Why is Pete Holmes? That's the question I think America's asking. Hey, if you don't know who he is, you've got a computer. Google his name. But Pete is just a very, very funny stand-up comedian.
Has his own show on HBO.
Yeah, and HBO specials. Mm-hmm. And he had this show called Crashing, which I thought was just... I feel like if you want to get to know him a little bit, I just think his personal side came through. It was just a really good show to watch, and I loved it. Yeah, he also is a former evangelical, raised in a pretty strict evangelical home, who had his own experiences. And a lot of what we're going to talk about today is just how he has come to look at his faith, whatever that looks like right now.
Well, he calls it Christ-leaning.
Christ-leaning.
It's Christ-leaning.
Yeah, interesting way of putting it. And just how he reads the Bible and just the nature of faith and God. And this comes out of a book that he just wrote.
Yep, Comedy, Sex, God by Pete Holmes. So that's the book we'll be talking about. But I mean, it's not really a book. I mean, Pete Holmes is a stand-up comedian, and he really is just talking about his life. So mm-hmm. we're talking about his life, his faith, and how he has come to see God in a new way. And I thought it was a refreshing, energizing new perspective on how to think about some of these things.
Yeah, I mean, his book was, for me, is like, he's really thought about this stuff. And it's funny, but that's what comedians do. They're funny, but there's also substance there too as well. They're woven together. And just, I think you'll agree, just talking with Pete, he's thought deeply about a lot of things, and he's read a ton of stuff, and he was just really interesting to talk to.
Yeah, he's no slacker. He's no slacker.
Did you think he would be, Jared? Is that what you're saying?
A slacker? Perhaps. Yeah. Yeah.
He's from L.A.
Yeah, exactly.
West Coast.
But he wasn't uptight. He's not East Coast. He didn't, But it was great. So let's get into this conversation with Pete Holmes.
Let's do that.
If you can't handle that, how are you going to handle a virgin birth? It's in the story. That is an invitation for your rational, dualistic, egoic mind to take a hike. This is not head stuff, it's heart stuff. It's trying to use the mind to beat the mind. And I know that's very unappealing to the Western mind that wants to know and know that we know. But you need to get that stuff out of here.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Pete Holmes, great to have you on our podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm thrilled. I really am.
Yeah, well, you kept calling, I figured, fine. Jeez, how would you shut this guy up?
Yeah, kept emailing. We were like, who is this guy?
Well, it is funny. Well, I know a lot of Christians that try and break away from the Christian market, the Christian audience, for lack of a better term. And I'm sort of the opposite. I really get excited when I can speak to people that were raised like I was or have similar questions that I do and deal with similar issues in the same vocabulary. So that's really exciting for me. I think it's harder to go to my audience. I can swing back to you guys, but it always gets me really excited when I do. So I'm happy to be here.
Excellent. Well, let's just jump right into that because we do want to spend a good amount of time on where are you now and how have you put pieces back together. But before we do that, just give us a little of your faith background and journey and how maybe it paralleled with your career and how those intersected. So just give us a little background.
Sure. I will say that off mic, we were talking about the difference between deconstruction and reconstruction. And I just have to say that, I mean, you're just tearing a page from the book in my heart. I'm just so bored with deconstruction. Mm-hmm. So many people, I give a 4-year maximum to your deconstruction phase. And I really like effing.
Is that in the Bible?
I don't know. It should be.
Probably. I'll find it.
Let's add an amendment. Like, I just feel like there's so many fun things to do to like tear down all these things that people handed you. And there's so many things to sort of like get angry about, or, you know, like it feels like this rebellion, right? But Rob Bell, who you guys know, who put mm-hmm. us in touch, is a dear friend of mine. And we did the speaking tour together. And every night he would say, there's this rabbinical teaching that any old donkey can tear down a barn, but it takes a special one to build one. And then I would riff on that, how funny it is to think of a donkey holding a hammer with his hooved hands and all that sort of stuff. But like, that is what I'm about. Like, I think when people know that I'm a Christian, know that I'm a comedian and that I'm interested in Christianity and interested in faith, they assume that I'm going to do what Carlin did. And I think Carlin was great,
yeah.
But that I'm going to be tearing it down and talking about, you really believe in a talking snake. And I'm like, can you please come at this more intelligently than a kindergartner? You know what I mean? Like, nobody believes that. I mean, some people do believe it literally, but there's so many people that know Semitic poetry. There's so many people that know how to read mythology overlaid over history. You know what I mean? Like, scholars, interesting, deep thinkers that appreciate literary approach and poetry and metaphor and myth and all of these things that are intelligent and soulful and wise, and to throw them away by being like, you think there's an old man in the sky. I'm just like, get over it. I can't stand it. And that is not what I'm about.
Yeah.
And that's not what my book is about either.
No, it's definitely not about that. And, you know, Jared and I have similar experiences where, you know, if your entire Christian faith is centered on defending what you believe and being right, I mean, all you do is argue. So when you start to deconstruct, that just stays with you.
You don't know
how else to be a Christian other than by arguing with people. And I think, I mean, I've experienced that myself, coming to the place of seeking peace and saying, I'm just tired of arguing about anything.
It's a waste of time. Being right and being wrong, or being in or being out, or cherry picking 5 to 10 to 15 to 25 Bible verses and then defending them is not what, in my interpretation, the gospel is about. It's not about being right. It's not even about being a good person. So many people say to me, they're like, look, we can agree. We're better with religion. And it sort of comes down to just be a good person. And I'm like, it is not boiled down to being a good person. That is ridiculous. Like, if Christ had gone around telling people to be a good person, would we still be talking about him 2,000 years later? And do you think there's really no one else in that time in Israel saying, be a good person? Do you really think that's radical enough of a message to start a revolution and to get yourself killed? It is so stupid. I'm not putting people down. Like, my parents are sort of people that think that it comes down to be a good person. But I'm like, that is not what's happening. Mm-hmm. It is so much more vibrant. It's so much more colorful and sexy and electric and alive and exciting. And it got ruined by the debating. It got ruined by the in and the out and the us and the them and the right or the wrong and the, oh, this text says Goliath was 13 feet tall and this one says he was about 6'6". Which one is right? And was it a literal 7-day creation? And why would God have to rest if he's get out of the way? This is not about being right. This is not about being in. The arrogance to think that you can contain infinity.
Yeah.
And even if you don't believe in God, we're talking about infinity. We're talking about something that is so expansive. Even an atheist, most of my friends are atheists, and I think they're beautiful people. I'm not trying to change them. We believe in infinite possibilities. And they, the better atheists that I know, will have the humility to admit that they do not know, and it's not even capable to house an infinite mystery in the four walls of their brain. And yet Christianity has been steam cleaned and ruined into this, as I say in my book, it's certainty worship and it's membership and it's an ego trip of we're right and they're wrong. And it's always your group that's right and it's every other group that's wrong, even amongst other Christians. It's a waste of time. It is not about being right. It is not even about being good or being polite. Oh, withhold your feelings about my stupid shirt and you're on Jesus's team. Like, you didn't say stupid shirt. You must be one of God's children. It is not about that. It is completely completely about revolutionizing and rewriting the very place or no place that you view reality. And that, as you said, Pete, I'm sorry I'm preaching, but I get passionate about this stuff. That is where peace is. That is where joy is. Not later, now, right now. Right. Where I view who is having anxiety changes how I interpret my anxiety. Do I identify with my anxiety? Am I in the world and of the world? Or am I in the world but not of the world? I see my anxiety from somewhere else now because I identify as spirit. And that changes the way that I interact with you. And it changes why I'm good. I used to be good because I was afraid of God because God was going to kick me into a furnace. And now I'm good because I see, as Christians would say, the indwelling spirit, the Holy Spirit in you. As the Hindus would say, the Atman, the soul that we all share, the peace of God that's inside of all of us. Then you treat people good, not for a reward later, but because you see them for what they really are, which is a piece of this, of the one thing that is undulating that we call reality. Yeah, I'm done. We can be done now.
No, that's fine. First of all, I mean, I appreciate the sermon. Jared just became a Christian just now.
You converted me.
Yeah, which is pretty awesome. I've been working on him with Bible verses for a long time. It hasn't been working. So, but you know, honestly, too, Pete, I think I've always thought of comedians as sort of preachers and prophets anyway, if they're doing it right. That's my little humble opinion because I'm not a comedian. But so I think what you're doing is and that stuff comes out in your work, I'm sure. You know, you're trying to drive home some of these points.
Yeah, one of the things I was thinking of is, you know, we talk about the boredom of deconstruction, but there was such a frustrating time in my life where I've begun to start seeing reconstructive as this like creative act. And creating something new is incredibly difficult.
Mm-hmm,
so, like, in my deconstruction phase, I had this blog, and I was like, from now on, I made this pronouncement, from now on, only positive, reconstructive, new ways of being Christian in the world. And it literally sat untouched for 5 years. Because I was like, oh, well, I actually don't know how to do that.
Yeah.
So I just had this immense respect for people who can reconstruct because it's such an energy. It is creating, whether it's creating in the arts or creating beauty in the world or creating love or creating connection or creating these new things, that takes a tremendous more effort than, like you said, sort of the donkey tearing down the barn.
Mm-hmm.
That's a bit of an easier thing. So, you know, have you sensed that as well? Was that an easy journey for you to reconstruct, or was it a painful, long-standing sort of figuring it out journey?
Well, the only way that I could come back to being Christ-leaning, I call myself Christ-leaning, and that's almost entirely psychological. The symbol systems that you inherit as a child are always going to be more powerful, I think, than ones that you discover in your mid-30s. And I think that's a psychological phenomenon, first and foremost. But the only way that I could sort of come back to enjoying the Bible and very much enjoying Christ is by getting rid of all of it. So I think that's super powerful. I often tell people I don't want them to agree with me. I don't want them to think the same thoughts as I think. I don't want them to have the same, as I say, symbol systems as I have. I want them to be free. And I think if you look at Jesus, he wants you to be free as well. And freedom sort of starts with zero. Making yourself zero, as Gandhi said, sort of makes your power infinite. Like, you need to start from a place where you drop your hometown, you drop your parents, you drop your desire to fit in, you even drop your desire to go to heaven or avoid hell or any of that stuff, and you make yourself zero. So when I was briefly atheist, I joke in the book that I was a heratheist because it felt like a relief to me to drop that horrible, of all the things that the church sort of gave me, the thing that I found the most traumatic was walking around with a pit in my stomach that everyone I knew pretty much was going to hell, with a very, very few exceptions. And I've started talking about that on stage as a stand-up, is that's a dark thing to go see your Jewish doctor who heals your broken arm and think, well, who's going to heal him when he's burning alive forever? And the only way that he can not do that is if I make him a clone of me. Because the quote in the book is, I say, it's a fucking shitty way to go through life, trying to turn other people into versions of you. It's just not what we're here to do. It's not the God that I see. Richard Rohr says that we've made a God that's like us instead of the other way around. I would add to that that like the God that we've made is angry. He wants to kick ass. He wants to destroy our enemies, and he wants to build us up with earthly riches. He wants to give us power. He wants to give us money. He wants to, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz? He wants to give us all the things that we just also so happen to value in modern Western culture. Like God is also adapted to inherit our values, which is of course nonsense. But the God that I see that we are living as a part of loves and cherishes diversity. But there's thousands of varieties of flowers and thorns and weeds. And as the Bible says, the sun and the rain falls on the just and the unjust alike, and it falls on the lilies and the roses alike. Yet when I was a rose, I was told to go out and make everyone into a rose instead of appreciating the lilies and the daisies and, you know, and the orchids. I was charged with a mission to turn everyone into my kind of flower, which is just, which is, like I said, is just a crappy way to live.
Yeah. And, so, and as you're saying, you know, you're talking about your brief time as an atheist, I think, and not to minimize it, but I think it's very healthy for people. Maybe not everybody, but for people to go through what you might call an atheist phase to press reset on everything, because the views of God that they have, of the infinite creator that they have, is very toxic.
Yeah.
And that's been downloaded for, you know, much of their lives. And the only way to start over again is to sort of like die to all that.
That's
or
right.
Have all that die to you. And, you know, if God is real, God can handle that.
Yeah.
God knows what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like, oh no, what's God thinking? It's like, oh, you can't even care about that. You just have to, like, I have to stop.
Obviously, I sort of have like a Eastern, more of an Eastern bent, and I would be like, God is forgetting himself and God is returning to himself. So it's not even some God somewhere else watching me and going, oh, Pete lost faith in me. It's more of a dance or a play where I'm forgetting myself and then I'm remembering myself. I love that Alan Watts, he doesn't say this, but I heard a talk that he gave, and the way that I summarize it is that an atheist is God's greatest creation. Because if this is just a play, you know what I mean? It's like I say, it's an undulating fountain of yes, of being. If we came here to sort of play hide and seek with ourselves, the person that absolutely fundamentally does not believe in a source or a creator is playing the game so beautifully. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. It's like getting lost in a movie so deeply that you forgot it was a movie, that it's actually the most exquisite way to play it. It's like, wow, he's so deep into it, he forgot himself. And that's kind of what he did to play this game in the first place. But that's sort of an interesting thought experiment. But once I let go of all that, I was free to slowly come back to it, and that was through the three steps in my book, which is Joseph Campbell, psychedelics, and then Ram Dass, which is the three steps I took.
Right.
Yeah, and I want to get into that a little bit, because I think Joseph Campbell, and just and we can move beyond Joseph Campbell, but just the idea of myth making symbolism and getting underneath how we, you know, we have to articulate things in our culture, in our language. It's something we talk about a lot on the podcast, and how there's, and how myth isn't a bad word, and how that can actually propel us into something else. But I, you know, just to kind of backtrack in that Eastern thought, thinking through, you know, we've had Richard Rohr on the podcast a few times, and I noticed you have that kind of in the further reading, and that idea of Christ in all of us and God in all of us. And how that is, I think that's a new thought for a lot of our listeners, because, you know, for me growing up, I would have taught at best that was New Age, and at worst that was like
God
paganism.
Hates you.
Yeah. Right.
No, I understand.
So how would you square that, or do you even try to square that with anything you grew up with? And you just kind of say, this idea of Christ consciousness or God in all of us is maybe a trajectory of what I grew up with. But yeah, in some ways I have to leave, to use Paul's language, we have to leave sort of childish things behind, and we develop and mature into a greater understanding of things.
Yeah. I mean, I think Pete said it too, was the idea of death and resurrection. I think that is what's going on in my own experience of faith, is that I died to what I call my inherited faith, and then I resurrected to it. And then obviously I start looking, the way that I read the Bible now, specifically the words of Jesus, I would say I lean on the most. I'm not too interested in the other stuff, even though I'm pretty familiar with it, but I really, I don't know why, I just kind of hang on Jesus more. But like, for example, when Christ says, you know, when what you do for the least of these, you do for me. When I was a kid, I took that as a guilt trip. And when I saw a homeless person, I would think, and there's nothing really wrong with this, it still ended in me doing something kind. I would give them food or money because I would think that that was Jesus. And the difference now is I see Jesus saying, or I see Christ saying, to be clear, he's saying, that's me, meaning that's all of us. Like, it's all one. When you give a sandwich to a homeless person, you're giving a sandwich to the only thing, the only game in town, which is Christ, which is this. So I see that as an invitation and a hint towards unit of consciousness. And to keep it in the Bible realm, because I know that's this podcast, when Jesus is saying, or rather Christ is saying, I'm the way and the truth and the life, no one comes to the Father except through me, I see that as he's speaking as the Christ, which is the same mystery that other traditions are also getting to. Richard Rohr, as you mentioned, is so good at tirelessly reminding people that claiming an exclusive connection through one place to the only, like, this is the only way to the thing that only we have, is always and only an ego trip. And to say that the native religions of America, and which, you know, I don't know if they're Catholic listeners, but the Pope said, like, there's nothing in Christianity that you guys didn't know already because they had such a deep connection to nature, or Indians or Jews or Muslims or anything like that. It's all one thing. I see Jesus speaking as the Christ, which is a place that when we're quiet, when we turn off our objective, dualistic thinking minds, we can get to that quiet little dollop of Christ in us. And when we're there, you see it's laughable the way that we try and contain and sell it and show it off like we have it. Look at our statues, look at our buildings, look at our funny hats. And that's what psychedelics did for me. It's like when you get in that place that is Christ consciousness, you're like, we're not even close. I tip our hat for us to try. But when you have a true mystical experience, you're like, this is ineffable. It's sweet that we're trying, but this is why myth, this is why metaphor, this is why parable, this is why music, this is why story, this is why art, because the only way to get at this is indirectly. To quote our friend Richard, myth is always true and sometimes really happened. That is what we're talking about. When I describe, just like Rob uses the same example, his love for his wife, he uses simile, he uses exaggeration, he uses illustration. Because when you just say, like, when I'm with my wife, you know, I'm aroused. What? That's nothing. It's not it. It's not it.
Yeah.
Well, you know, well, there's something really I appreciated, even how you said that, of the... when, like, the homeless idea of when you do this to the least of these, you do this to me. And it's a flipping of the power dynamic from, I like to talk about the moving from to with, that you're doing this to someone rather than we're doing it with. We are a part of this.
That's right.
And there's something really powerful about that. But I also wanted to check in about, you said Christ leaning. And you mentioned something like, when you have this experience, this mystical experience of the ineffable, there's something that could lead to not labeling yourself as anything. And so is there worth in, I call it kind of having conviction without exclusion? And it seems like a really difficult road to walk of how we're convicted. Yeah. Like, I would identify as a Christian, but not to the exclusion of others. And that seems like a really difficult thing to do.
It is. Well, welcome to the paradox, baby. It's the pathless path. It's a path, but it's not a path. And if you can't handle that, how are you going to handle a virgin birth? It's in the story. It's a pregnant virgin. That's what faith is. It's a pregnant virgin. That is an invitation for your rational, dualistic, egoic mind to take a hike. This is not head stuff, it's heart stuff. And it puts these paradoxes and these contradictions and these weird mysteries, almost like a Zen Buddhist koan. It's trying to use the mind to beat the mind. It's like, you want to come in here? As Muji says, take off your shoes. Your shoes are like your thinking mind. And I know that's very unappealing to the Western mind that wants to know, as Ram Dass says, we want to know and know that we know, right? Mm-hmm. But you need to get that stuff out of here. To quote Richie Rohr, we're going to quote Richie a bunch. He says, that we all got lost in worshiping the signpost. There are all these signs that say this way to Detroit. And we've taken those signs and we've put them in buildings and we pray to them and we worship them. And he goes, at a certain point, you're going to have to just go to Detroit. So Christ-leaning, because Jesus as a teacher and as a symbol and as an energy is very powerful to me and is great, but it, not to the exclusion. When you get into that place of oneness, you see that it doesn't really make any difference what gets you there. Like I write in the book, I tell the story about what about the guy that's stranded on a desert island. He doesn't hear about Jesus. He goes to hell. That's what I used to think. And I was like, that guy is with Christ. Christ is looking out of his eyes. You know what I'm saying? Like Christ is the thing that's giving him his being. It's like Richie says, you know, Yahweh, the name Yahweh is like the in-breath and the out-breath. It's on his lips whether or not he adopts our symbol system, our story structure, our holy books or our songs or our buildings. Those are just places that are supposed to give you the experience. But we've gotten lost in worshiping other people's experiences, right? We trust that someone somewhere, St. John of the Cross, he had a religious experience. I'll just read about his. No, go on and have one. And don't just worship Christ's. Go and do likewise, as I say in the book. Get on with it. To bring the Bible in, Christ says, you'll do far greater things than these. What is he talking about? Was that just an aside? Was that something we're going to conveniently look past? He's saying, get on with it. Don't worship my transformation. Get to transforming yourself.
Hey, everyone. My name's Dave Carlton, and I'm in my basement with a flashlight, and I'm looking for some kids' clothes, and I can't find them. And anyway, while I'm down here and it's quiet, I figured I'd read this for you. This podcast is brought to you by supporters on the Patreon platform. For as little as $1 per month, you can be part of the group that brings this podcast to normal people everywhere. You'll also be bringing the podcast to some weird people, like me. So if that word normal has been holding you back, I don't think they're strict about it. Go to patreon.com/thebibleforNormalPeople. I actually really like being part of the producers group. In my life now, I don't often get a chance to give people feedback about their creative work, and that's something I enjoy, so it's special for me. With that in mind, I want to thank my fellow producers, Jonathan Beck, Lucas Gibbs, Rachel Taylor, Brock Beasley, Nolan Archer, Kristen Backman, A. Todd Rivetti, and Layla Fry. The Bible for Normal People wouldn't be the same without you. Now back to the podcast.
You know, you mentioned paradox, and that's a hard thing for people to wrap their heads around, obviously, because it's a paradox. But I guess I think what you're saying is that the purpose of paradox is exactly that, to show us the inadequacies of our rational minds for apprehending, so to speak, or communing with God.
Mm-hmm.
And then myth, you know, I mean, I think, can we talk about that a little bit? Because I know that is such a negative word for people. It's not for me. It's not for Jared. It's a word that actually describes an awful lot of our lives and about any religious faith. But that's a trigger word for people too, as you know. Yeah. Like you didn't grow up in youth group hearing about myth. If you did, it was totally negative. So just for our listeners, explain what you mean by that. Like, what is myth and why is it a good thing?
Yeah, I vividly remember when I identified as an evangelical, if somebody called the Bible a myth, my body I'd have a visceral reaction. Like my stomach would churn and I'd feel those pins and needles of anger and heat. And I'd be very insulted if somebody called the Bible a myth. But that's why the way at an unknowable infinite reality is not going to be a direct line. We want it to be like building a bridge or designing a medicine. You know what I'm saying? Like we want it to be this precise, repeatable, Greek logic, Western, rational way of thinking about God. when you need, I think Richard says the two essentials, no matter what approach you have to coming to God, is patience and humility. And I think a lot of times we lose that humility in favor of, like your book, Pete, certainty. We want to have certainty, and we totally lose our patience, and we totally lose our humility. So myth is a way of saying there are truths that are so big that you can only sort of see them in your periphery. It's almost like looking at a magic eye painting. Remember those magic eye paintings? You sort of have to look past it, and then the truth would kind of emerge in this fleeting, but you know what I'm talking about? Like the sailboat would suddenly be visible. That's sort of how I feel about eternal truth and myth being the way that we can get at it. But you know, there's the myth, for example, of the Garden of Eden sort of ties into what we're talking about. Is I see the Garden of Eden as being one with God, unitive. We used to argue about where in Africa was it. But now when I read, yeah, right? What a waste of time. Now I read it and I'm like, this is I can't believe the geniuses that wrote these stories that I believe were, I don't believe divine inspiration is over, by the way. I think it's happening all around. I don't think there's another kind of inspiration, to be honest. But in the Garden of Eden, you're with God. You don't see separation, right? And then they eat of the knowledge of good and evil. That's duality, good and evil, yes and no, black and white, clothed and naked, man and woman. I was just thinking about this in the shower the other day. It's funny that Adam and Eve didn't have children until they left the Garden of Eden. That's a very interesting idea, right? Is like if you were in paradise with a naked person of the opposite sex, you'd think you'd have sex all the time, right? And therefore you'd have a lot of children. But they didn't do it until they left. If I was a pastor, this is what I would preach on. That's because there's no need to have sex when you are Eve. Adam is Eve. Eve is Adam. And they are God. And they are the garden. And they are the animals. And then they eat of the knowledge of good and evil. Duality is entered in. And it was our choice. We had a hand in it. We elected, we wanted the experience of separation. And then we started having sex. And then we started having kids because we were craving that union again that we had been kicked out of. And that's the situation I find ourselves in here. Now, what I just did there is a mythic interpretation of a story that if you look at it just literally is flat and boring and arbitrary. Like, it's not that boring, but it's not that interesting either. Myth says, why is it in there? If it's not literally true, why is it in there? Why did they include it? Because this is how Semitic literature works. They're doing these things for a reason. Like I had Alex Shaya on my podcast, and he was like, a Semitic storyteller talking to a poor person will tell a story about someone getting robbed of $10. But if he's talking to a rich person, he'll tell a story about someone getting robbed of $1 million. Because the facts don't matter. The feeling matters. The audience matters. That's why we see the difference in the four Gospels. Who are they talking to? How can they get you there? It's a by any means necessary, will you transcend yourself? Will you die to yourself? We're asking a pretty big ask. And fact or not, we just want you here. God is seducing you by any means necessary to transform and convert your heart into your true self. So the Western mind would like to know where the Garden of Eden is on the globe. The mystic mind says you are missing the point. It's about transforming your soul.
Well, I think the biblical writer meant that too, because as if to leave no doubt that we're in the realm of story here, it's like, all right, let's have a talking animal and two magic trees in the middle. That should get the point across pretty quickly that we're dealing with something here that is not of historical purpose.
Yeah. I'm so bored when people are like, so Cain and Abel, they had kids, and then what? Who are these people that they're marrying? I'm like, get out of the way. We're trying to explain the phenomenon of consciousness. One of my big points, talk about the Bible. I'm quoting the Bible all the time. is that God says his name is I am that I am. So this is the first metaphor that we have for being itself, for consciousness, for the quality of existence. And then, of course, we tell stories, and I don't mean to offend some of the people that really love the Bible. I like the Bible too, but these metaphors are always going to evolve and change, and some of the things we're going to drop them because they were human beings interpreting an infinite mystery. This is when people are like, what about the slavery in the Bible? What about the misogyny in the Bible? What about the homophobia in the Bible? I'm like, yeah, the text, the ideas, the consciousness, the pulse of these things, the ego wants to seal them like forever in a vault and be like, God said it, that does it, I believe it, right? That is not what's going on. We are the Word of God. We are the love of God. We are constantly in motion, defining and redefining what it is. It's a river. The ego wants to turn it into a statue. This is where Buddha comes in and goes, it's all on fire, baby. And that's I like some of that Eastern perspective to be like, what are you on about thinking you're right? Get over it.
Well, it's interesting, just a side note, because my background's more in philosophy, is I think Western philosophy has moved toward that in as it integrates with physics in terms of, I think of the philosopher like Bergson and Gilles Deleuze, where it has the same kind of unified consciousness idea as part of that. But really what I want to say is, I'm summarizing this, it's blowing my mind, because what I'm getting from this is sex is a result of the fall. So the fall is good, and we should be grateful for it? Is that the logic that we're coming to here?
You know, it's so funny. I had the comedian Sinbad on my podcast, and he did this really funny riff about marriage, and he was like, the two become one. He goes, that's subtraction. And I thought that was really funny, right? And so many of us view marriage. So marriage is a metaphor, right? Myths and metaphors aren't just for the Bible, and they aren't just for other spiritual texts. I'm not a literal believer necessarily, meaning I'm open to literal versions of the Bible. I'm literal versions of the Bhagavad Gita. I'm open to anything because that's my humility. I'm not here to say that this definitely didn't happen. It's definitely a metaphor. I am firmly planted in a place of unknowing. So if a literal interpretation of the Bible gets you there, by the way, stick with it. Like, go ahead, as long as you're not hurting other people, get there however you need to get there. But I believe that a wedding is a beautiful, we've lost it, but Joseph Campbell is one of those people that helped me regain the meaning of a wedding. The two becoming one. Every Christian wedding I've seen, they have the two candles lighting the one candle, and it just seems like a saccharine sort of nauseating cliche. But what it is it's a ceremony of a small example of what we are all to do, which is to wake up to our interconnectedness. You mentioned physics. Einstein and Christ agree in the way that I read them that this is one thing, the one split into the many. And that's not an error. This isn't a holding room. This isn't a test. This is the play of the divine. That's why my daughter's name is Leela. Leela means the dance of the universe, the dance of the divine. It's what we're doing. We're playing to learn about love, to learn about separation, to learn about pain, to learn about all of it, because it wants to know itself and to grow and evolve and experience. Because, I mean, think about it. If you were everything, what would you do? What game, to quote Michael Gunger's book, This, it's an incredible book. It changed my life. He says, if you were infinity, what game wouldn't you play? You'd play all the games. Because if you were one consciousness, you could make yourself feel the rush of a million orgasms. For how long? For how long are you going to do that? But to quote Alan Watts, before you make a button that says something happens. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You push it and something happens. That's why we're going deeper and deeper into this, to lose ourselves, to learn about ourselves, and then ultimately return to ourselves.
Well, and if this seems kind of, you talk about Eastern mysticism, but I just want to name that writers like Lakoff and Johnson and some others just talk about this idea that metaphor, there's these meta metaphors. And up so much. I had a class on metaphor once, and it was so frustrating how we couldn't even like talk for 10 seconds before we were talking in metaphor again. Like we kept trying to find ways not to talk in metaphor, and language itself is quite metaphoric, and it participates in these, hey, left took a, you know, life took a right turn.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's participating in this life is a journey metaphor. Like, what do you mean by that?
Right.
And so just language itself, it just language itself points to the fact that we are human and we don't have access to reality as it is.
It's beautiful.
We only have access to reality as it's interpreted through our culture, and we call that metaphor.
And as we can think about it. So this is a big point that I got from Ram Dass is we want consciousness without an object, right? So we've turned God into an object because that's what language does. You see a tree. When my daughter, who's 10 months old, looks at a tree, she sees a tree in the way that I believe Christ saw a tree. Because that's my favorite Bible verse is lest ye be converted and become as little children, ye shall not enter the kingdom of God, right? He's saying, stop labeling, as Eckhart Tolle would say, judge not, lest ye be judged, right? All of the major religions have some version of don't judge. And we used to mean like, don't put down people. No, stop labeling. Stop comparing and contrasting. And we've created God into a thing over there so that we can think about it by virtue of how language works. But ultimate reality doesn't conform to the way that we've constructed our worlds. It's ultimate reality. So we need a way to quiet our minds. This is where psychedelics came in, and then later meditation, breathing techniques, contemplation, all of these types of things come into silence, because when we think about God, we're always a thought removed, as Ram Dass would say. We're a thought away from where the action is. I've related to this to museums, to sex, to dance, to music. If you watch two people dancing and you're thinking about dancing, you are missing it. You're supposed to experience it. You're supposed to stop thinking and merge with it. So I'm not really selling necessarily equality with God. I'm talking about dissolving where the idea of me over here and God over there disappears, and that sort of question becomes irrelevant, if that makes sense.
No, it makes a lot of sense. I just happen to be reading now Martin Laird's Into the Silent Land. I keep saying Shadowland because I'm thinking of C.S. Lewis. Anyway, Into the Silent Land. But he makes this point, and it really struck me, I think, very much what you're saying now, Pete, that objectifying God is like the big Western problem.
Yeah.
God is out there, and we control the. I mean, think about this. Like you've been ranting about, we think we can control the infinite through our language, and God is out there instead of, you know, the journey. It truly is inward. If you know, as Christians confess, if we're made in the image of God, and if the Spirit of Christ dwells in us, you know, looking in is not a bad idea.
Yeah.
Rather than looking outward to that thing that we can control, and you know, as you know. Again, confession time here, as you know, I'm a scholar. So what else do you think I do but objectify everything?
That's right.
You know, and I've had to learn through crap and through a lot of stuff that's happened that it ain't working, Petey. This is not going to happen that way.
Yeah, no, so, but you know, that's that humility. I love that. I do that too. It's a very tricky game, right? When you ask me how I relate to the Bible, I would never literally do this, but Alan Watts sort of suggests that you should burn the Bible every Easter. And I am not saying you should do that literally, and he did not do that literally. But anything that makes you think that it's out there is in the way. So in Buddhism, they have a very similar thing that I think people are familiar with, which is if you see the Buddha, kill the Buddha. Because the Buddha is, as I love to say, is looking out your eyes right now. Christ is looking out your eyes right now. God and Yahweh, the inhale and the exhale, it's as close as the air on your skin. And we've forgotten, and we've fallen asleep, and we've learned to associate with our minds and our egos and our roles and our possessions and our genders and our identities and our nationalities, and all of that has to go. That is, so religion does not summarize to be a good person.
Well, okay, why do we do that? Like, why do we objectify? Why do we have this problem? What do you think about that?
I think it's a problem only in how long you do it. I think it's necessary. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
I absolutely think I still do it, and I use it as a...
I objectify that car coming at me.
Absolutely.
And right, okay, it's a good thing.
I hold on to Christ as an image. I need it. whatever mm-hmm. gets you there, if the object of Christ helps me merge and move beyond subject-object Christ and become Christ consciousness, then it is paying out, and it works, and it's helpful. And it's kind of all we can do. You know, when we talk about how we have to reduce reality into language, which is one of the reasons why I think a lot of us are walking around with like a low level of depression, is because it's a little bit sad that all we have is language. We're all having these very personal, internal, mysterious experiences, and they get reduced and steam cleaned and homogenized and pasteurized into like, I feel blue. And that is such a stupid, it's so stupid to make clicks and clacks and oohs and ahs and that's us. That's not us. And it's not God either.
Yeah, but we were taught to do that, I guess.
The best we can do. It's the best we can do.
Yeah. And I don't know why I feel the need to keep defending the West, but I just think of, you know, Kierkegaard, who says truth is subjectivity. And he was so passionate about this move to the inward and how Christian faith is about this. We keep making God an object. We keep making these things objective, and that our faith is in this objectivity when truth is subjectivity. Truth is the enactment. It's the embodiment. It's getting in that dance.
That's why they hated him.
Right. That's why he was pretty rejected.
Now, I don't want to be, you know, I'm not even a crazy drug person. I've done psychedelics a handful of times in my life. But to me, there's this, Ram Dass said there was this expression in India when he was like, what's going on with LSD and mushrooms and all these things? And they were like, well, the West is a materialistic society, so God came to you as a material. That's sort of what I'm talking about when I say that God is seducing you. It's a little bit like the Hound of Heaven. It's like, what's it going to take? Would you please, I'm standing at the door and knocking. You know what I mean? Like, what is it going to take? Because God, I'm speaking metaphorically, God is also craving the union back to us. I love bhakti yoga. I love the idea of God as lover. You know what I mean? The intimacy that is supposed to be there, I think, is helpful to me. So psychedelics, when you have it, and not everybody has to have it, and I'm not even necessarily advocating it to your listeners, I'm just saying for me, when I took it, instead of thinking about what unitive consciousness might be like, I didn't even know what that was, I experienced it. You know, and then once you are there, you sort of have the roadmap back to it through meditation and through contemplation and through prayer. You sort of realize, you know, I've turned a lot of Christians on to psychedelics, and we have these ecstatic dinners where we go, I told you, it's real. Like, something is going on here. Like, it's not.
It's almost like training wheels. It's like training wheels for a mystical experience, because Western people have difficulty getting to it through the only channels that they're really familiar with.
Yeah.
Right?
I wish my faith had been great enough to just be like, I trust that something is going on here. They said it, and I take their word for it. Because of the way that I was viewing God, I needed a tactile experience. But I'm very happy to say that while I still occasionally do psychedelics, it stays an open channel for me. That when I'm in the moment with people, as I'm being with you right now, as I'm speaking with you, I can still feel it. Obviously, the room isn't squiggling and changing. It's just a presence chemical. It's a chemical that puts you in eternity, which isn't something that starts when we die. It's something that we are always a part of, and we've applied the illusion of time because of a rock moving around, a burning rock that happens every 365 days. I mean, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. Eternity is right now. We're in it right now. Where else could we be?
Right. Well, that's a very Jesus-y thing to say, too, I think.
Dude, when you start looking back, and he's like, look at the birds of the air, and look at, you know, whenever he's talking about nature and the vine and the fruit and all that sort of stuff, when I took mushrooms for the first time, I felt so at home on Earth, and I felt so, like, I felt that inherent dignity, as opposed to the narrative that, and I might have misunderstood, maybe they didn't mean to give me this, but I had a very much like a, this is not my home, I'm just passing through sort of attitude, which was that God made a simulation to test my character and to test my ethics. He put me in a virtual reality, basically, which I was not actually a part of, and that I would spend much more time not in this world. I'd be in heaven. And now I'm like, this is it. This is the body of Christ. This is it. It's all in the game. Richard says, you know, he taught me, I wish I read the Bible this carefully. He talks about Jesus saying, let the weeds grow with the wheat. And that's another one of my favorite verses where I'm just like, it's all in it. We're not in this to just do willpower Christianity, as Richard calls it, which is just pushing the boulder away. There's something beautiful about coming to terms with your neuroses and your anxiety and not feeling like you've betrayed or lack faith, but to dissociate with them and go like, that's happening. Pete is having anxiety, but the real me is in a be still and know that I am. I'm God. It's in here. It's looking out. It's all in the game. The weeds and the wheat are welcome. Like they're growing at the same rate. I'm still angry sometimes. I'm still horny sometimes. I'm still selfish and all these things. And it's not a flaw in the system. I'm not here to be phony. My God is truth and freedom and honesty. And it sucks that we can be more honest with our therapists than we can with our Christian friends. You know, I have to pay a secular person to tell him that this is what's going on in this psychology and this personality and these dysfunctions, where the God that I know sees and understands all of it and knows that it's not the real me anyway. That is the false self, and it's going to go, and the real self isn't going anywhere.
Yeah. Well, listen, Pete, we'd love to talk with you for hours.
You can. I don't have to go.
We do, unfortunately. Maybe we can make this round one. I mean, this was so much fun just to chat with you. And hopefully this will give, you know, Crashing Season 4 a jump start for, I don't know, because I love that show. But
listen,
what are you working on now? Like, do you have any projects, anything, you know, television and stuff? We knew you have a new HBO special that came out not super long ago. I'm trying to think of when one came out. Pretty recently, right?
Dirty Clean. It's called Dirty Clean because I swear, but people consider me a clean comic, which I always take as a very nice compliment.
Your haircut, man.
It's my haircut. There's some interesting jokes about consciousness in that special if people watch it.
Yeah, I did, yeah. Okay, yeah. It's good stuff.
I would like to talk again. I did say I get very excited when I'm speaking to a Bible reading and Christian-leaning audience, so forgive me for talking so much, because I would love to talk with you guys as well, because I know I've been reading your book, and it sounds like you guys have a lot to offer as well. So we should do it again.
Yeah, I appreciate, and we should, and yeah, don't apologize for being excited to talk about things that are close to your heart and that you've experienced, because, I mean, that's the connection, you know, that unit of connection with a lot of our listeners who are just, they're in a place of mess and deconstruction, and, you know, and I think a lot of what you said today is going to resonate with an awful lot of people.
I appreciate
that. Yeah, it was great to have you. Yeah, thanks, and let's do it again, by all means. How about every week?
Well, I'd love to do it again. I'm going to write another book. The first book is called Comedy Sex God, and there's been enough ideas. Like that Adam and Eve thing, I'm like, that's got to go in the new book. I think it's so interesting. I was so close
How about a book of Bible stories?
A book of Bible stories. Well, I do like, one of the greatest thrills of my life is going back and finding not a truer or better or anything, just another way to look at Bible stories, because I really do think it's a masterpiece in so many ways.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's the beauty of you know, our friend Rob, and just what he brings to the world is just a wonderful reimagining and reinterpretation of things that we've heard 1,000 times in a new way.
And that's valuable. I think, and if I can plug something else that I have nothing to do with, it's Richard Rohr. It's on iTunes. It's called False Self, True Self. And you'll see that I always footnoted him, but like, that's where I'm getting a lot of these wonderful ideas. Richard, I love Rob's work, and Richard does it a little bit differently. He does it more like a get over yourself, which I like a lot. Rob is sort of rescuing the Bible. Richard is sort of like, it's not even about that. Yeah. Do you know the difference? Exactly. Like, Rob?
What
is the Bible? Yeah. I think is also incredible, and people should check it out. But it definitely has sort of like a, see, it is cool, you guys. And Richard is like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Just get over here. Get over here. Get over. Yeah. Go to Detroit.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much again for taking out some time, Pete. It was great to talk to you. And I echo Pete's words that this is going to be really valuable.
I love talking about it. Please have me back on and we'll chat again.
Absolutely. Thanks, Pete.
Okay, bye, guys.
Well, thanks everyone for tuning in for this episode of The Bible for Normal People. Today, talking about comedy, sex, God, Pete Holmes. Check out his book, pick it up. We really had a good conversation with Pete and just appreciate how he's able to navigate this world of comedy and having his own show and this creative force and also still thinking deeply about things like God and faith and the Bible. And I just was really impressed with how he was able to articulate and talk about things that we're interested in here.
Yeah, me too. Me too, absolutely.
Just a reminder, we will have a live class on Genesis September 23rd as a lead-up, as a ramp-up for the launch of our second edition of our book, Genesis for Normal People. But this is a class, one night only, on Genesis. We normally charge for these classes because they take time and energy. We probably charge about $100 for this kind of thing. But in this case, no human is going to be turned down for lack of funds. You just pay what you want. And we'd love to have you join us for that. Learn a little bit about Genesis. Get to know some other folks. Pete will be leading that and teaching that. So you can just go to thebiblefornormalpeople.com/course. And you can look at there. It's also on the homepage of the website when you get there. So one night only. Class on September 23rd. Pay what you want. We hope to see you there. All right. Well, thanks again. And we'll see you next time.
See ya.